Welcome to the Taylor Report, CIUT 89.5 FM. I'm Phil Taylor, your host. And I'll start by saying we understand that there are talks supposedly going on, or maybe going on, we'll see, between Ukraine representatives and those of Russia on the border of Belarus. Let us hope that is true. We'll have more to say about it later in the program. The first thing, though, I will say about it before we even get to that is we should be reminded of Bertrand Russell's observation about Western freedom. He says, in the West, we have our freedom until we need it. And I say that because I notice some programs disappearing from Canadian viewers are not able to see, but that's, I'm sure, in their best interest. I think it might have made Bertrand Russell's point. But I want to start today by talking about rather tragic, I don't know why I say rather, tragic situation in regard to people tried by the International Criminal Tribunal for Rwanda, who were acquitted or had served their time, and find that international justice leaves them without any home to go to when their time is served or after their acquittal. And Robin Philpott, publisher of Baraka Books, has written about this, and his articles have been two published in recent months and at Canadian Dimension. I urge you to go to the site, Canadian Dimension, you'll find them there. This is a subject that, of course, Taylor Report has followed, and we really want our listeners to be aware of this particular chapter, tragic chapter of the Rwanda story. So we welcome Robin Philpott to the program. How are you doing, Robin?
Very well, Phil. Thanks for inviting me.
I'll start with your most recent article. It's titled International Criminal Justice Bears Its Colonial Fangs. Yeah. Why are acquitted and freed Rwandans sitting in modern day penal colonies? That's a great title, and I'll let you answer your own questions. What is this? Why are they've been acquitted and freed? So, and why are they still in sort of semi-custody? And you had mentioned penal colonies. I'll let you elaborate.
Yeah, well, people remember penal colonies were set up by the British, the French, mainly, but other powers as well, where they would send people off to the colonies, and they would spend a long time there, and it's just almost like a long way away, out of sight, and one of the famous cases was Dreyfus, when they sent him to Devil's Island, which is down by in South America, near South America, off of the French Guiana, if I'm not mistaken. Yes. But there were penal colonies. The British sent Quebec patriots off to the to Australia to penal colonies. You know, they exiled, and some of these people, their families, have been grown up in Australia, and they have Quebec names, surnames. And this is 180 years ago.
They went to Australia and some other places.
Yeah, as well. But some made it back. But it was the way that the big imperial powers would deal with people they wanted to get rid of, and they sent them to these colonies. And if you look at what has been is being done with these nine Rwandan freed and acquitted people, I mean acquitted and some wrongly accused and acquitted people, and way they're being shuffled from one country to the next, and they're being refused entry into the countries such as Canada, the US, Britain, France, Denmark, one or two others, where the Netherlands, Belgium, where they have family, In other words, there are people who were tried, released, or had spent a certain time in prison, and then they're out, supposedly free, but they're basically they're in house arrest. Now, some of them it's been 25 years, and they've been they had to wait for their trials. The one case is that I've talked about before, and you, I think you had people in your program, Jerome Bichimampaka, who is in now Arusha, who was wrongly accused. He waited for 12 years for his trial. Then he was acquitted, among other things, because he was not even in the country when the events that for which he was accused took place. He was acquitted in 2011. It's 11 years now, and he hasn't been able to leave Arusha. His family is here in Montreal, and he cannot join them because Canada refuses to carry out the decision, to respect the decision of this tribunal, Canadians participated a lot. You know, the second chief prosecutor was Louise Arbour. People, defense lawyers, investigators, and many other people participated in from Canada. This tribunal, which was created with lofty principles, reached decisions, but they didn't. There was no plan about where they would be if they were condemned. Where would they spend their sentence? Where would they go after? And if there were acquittals, none of this had been thought out. And
I have to interrupt you. I mean, it is possible that some of them may have understood what they were doing in a sense, right? Because not every one of them was looking for a job. Some of them had theories, and they were selling this as a marvelous justice system. I suppose they must have thought there must have been a devil in their detail was that they assumed that everybody was guilty.
Yeah.
And they would never get out of anything. I mean, they would die in prison, seemed to be the working notion. But beyond that, they, like you said, there wasn't any plan. Those very designers, most of whom are alive and walking around with good jobs now, mm-hmm. I don't see them going back and saying, I participated in that and I never intended for an innocent person to be still stuck in limbo.
Right, right. Well, as you know, and maybe some of the listeners know already, that I interviewed the former Secretary General of the UN. It was in 2002, it's almost 20 years ago. And he was the person who he oversaw the creation of the tribunal. And he said, it was a mistake to send it to Arusha. And that's one thing. And in other words, there is a question here is why are they not in The Hague, where international criminal justice is based? But he said, we sent it to Arusha. And this is 8 years after the creation. And he says it was a mistake. But he also added, and I quoted in the article, that he said, this nobody thought or nobody considered all the paralegal aspects of it. If somebody is found guilty, where are they going to spend their sentence? If they're acquitted, nothing. None of those questions, which makes one think that, and it makes one conclude that those who were designing that tribunal had other goals. And that is where the question of Victor's justice comes in. Because, and Ramsey Clark made it very clear, he said, it's war by other means, because the power to determine who would be accused, who would be indicted and brought before the court, remained in the hands of the people who won that war, which is the Rwandan Patriotic Front, that's still in power under the same man, Kagame, who led that army. They control the information. So they were the ones who decided basically who was going to be indicted. And as this is Louise Arbour has said in interviews, that we could not do anything without the approval of the Rwandan government. We could not investigate. And when asked, why didn't you investigate the RPF? And they said, well, it was undoable. It was impossible to do it because how could you go in there and accuse people who are in power?
And on that, my memory from, I, of course, was at work there at the for Ramsey Clark, and my memory is that Arbour gave an really ugly, pragmatic explanation. She said that if we were to investigate the RPF, and they knew that we were going to do that, if they knew that, then we would be prevented from doing our investigations in Rwanda against those already charged. But that is, when she said that, should have been the immediate reason to close down the court, because what you're saying is, well, I can't investigate him because he might deprive me of my house over in Kigali, where I was working. Well, then obviously that's the end of the judge should say, throw the case out. But instead everybody accepted this really noxious political explanation of why you wouldn't persecute somebody who is suspected of a war crime.
Exactly. And so, I'm going to get back to the people who are in this tragic situation now, but the former U.S. ambassador for war crimes issues, David Sheffer was his name. He basically revealed what was going on in his memoirs. And he said, he described what he was doing with the tribunals, the one in Yugoslavia and Rwanda. And he said, I'd worked hard. I had worked with Madeleine Albright, who was the person who was sort of led it through the UN in 1994. She was Secretary of State, but prior to that, she was US ambassador to the UN. And with Madeleine Albright and with the President Clinton, I'd fashioned the tribunal so it would work in the advancement of US and NATO interests.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, he just said, this is what we were doing. We fashioned the tribunal in such a way that it was used to advance US and NATO interests. Now, that is not justice. That is a victor's justice because, as I say, it wasn't just the RPF that won. It was their sponsors, which was primarily the US, but also Canada and the UK, mainly. And this is what they were doing. So it is not surprising that we have a situation where these 11 Rwandans, are eight, I might say nine Rwandans, and others who are in other countries, by the way. As I said, you know, penal colonies, they're shipped from one country to the next in Africa, never to The Hague, by the way. And these 11 people, now, nine people, sorry, there are eight in Niger. Three of them were acquitted. That means they should walk free and be able to go wherever they want. In Arusha. They were transferred to Niger under pressure because the mechanism or the tribunal, and now it's called the mechanism, it put them under pressure and said, listen, you're going to be transferred there. You're going to be free to go. You're going to have papers, identity papers. You're going to have a certain amount of money, and for you to transition into normal civilian life.
If I could just ask you, isn't there a detail that they also had to sign that saying they had no further claim on the tribunal.
Yeah, and it was under no coercion, but they were being told that if you don't do this, well, then you'll be extradited to Rwanda. So they were being told that, but they signed it. These eight men were many of a certain age, you know, like they're in their 70s and some in their 80s, 60s, 70s and 80s. They decided they would do this because it would live for the rest of their life. They'll have some kind of freedom. They get transferred there on the 5th of December. 2 weeks later, it was 27th of December, in fact, Niger expels them, says they have to leave the country within 7 days. And the reasons were diplomatic reasons.
With what papers? If you tell someone to leave your country, he doesn't have papers.
That doesn't
happen. And you tell him to leave.
Yeah, exactly.
How are you supposed to do that?
Yeah, exactly. So there was a bit of a kerfuffle, and finally the mechanism gave an order to Niger, but they didn't take the responsibility and said, they should have just taken them back and said, we're moving them to The Hague. That is where international justice takes. So after a certain amount of time, they ordered Niger. Niger agreed to extend their staying time in Niger for a month. And then after that, the mechanism said that they would take responsibility for them. And they said they would transfer them back to Arusha in Tanzania. That's 3 weeks now. They said within 7 days. And now it's been 3 weeks. That's 21 days.
And incidentally, we may as well identify, that seems to be a problem in that we have not heard the voice of Tanzania itself. We've heard someone who represents the tribunal, but referring to their desire, They created a new headache as though the prisoners needed more. I should say the released individuals.
The free men.
Yeah, they don't have any. Now they've got them in a beyond limbo. I mean, they were once in Tanzania legally. Now they're out of Tanzania. They're in Niger. They're to return, perhaps, because that obviously turns on the discretion of the government of Tanzania.
Right. Exactly.
And incidentally, an answer for this might be, and Peter Robinson and John Philpott, with whom you're related, and many other lawyers have said, okay, you, the tribunal, are responsible. You do have a headquarters, and that's at The Hague. Mm-hmm. But for Africans, going to The Hague seems to be a huge problem, not something the tribunal doesn't want to think about.
No.
Why is that?
Exactly. And that's why
it's not part of the penal colony system, right?
Well, it's a judicial apartheid. It's like you have international criminal justice. The International Criminal Court now is in The Hague. The International Court of Justice is in The Hague. Though the trials in Yugoslavia went on in The Hague, the people were imprisoned in The Hague. But no, the Africans get shuffled around from one country to the next. Now, at the same time as they're refusing to, and these people, once again, they're acquitted, freed people, freed. And, you know, they could take them to The Hague and then they would, you know, have papers in that country, because that country has agreed, and they get a lot of money from the UN in Holland. But no, they're not doing it. And at the same time as this is going on, five prisoners in Mali were about to renew their, I'm not sure whether there's one that anybody's freed there, were about to renew their visa to stay in the country. And they were told their visas would not be renewed. So here you have, and it's they have five other people in Mali, and then there are prisoners in Benin, and there are prisoners in Senegal. Now, if that isn't a system of penal colony, and the people responsible for this are the Security Council, the Security Council, set up that tribunal in November 1994, and they are responsible for this. And nobody wants to talk about it. Try and get an article in thankfully, I'm going to thank the Canadian Dimension for running the article in French. It ran it in Le Journal, and they ran it in on a website in France called the Réseau International, the article. But you cannot get this article into our media. You can't. The subject is not discussed.
Yes.
And I say that right now at a period where all our media right now are lecturing the world about freedom mm-hmm. and democracy. Yes. Yet, and these same countries.
Well, there's words, human rights, every individual, they have to have. Yeah. You have to have the it's an international covenant that we all agreed to with the UN yeah. that the individual will, wherever he is in the world, she will have these rights.
Yeah.
But yeah. they are somehow through the magic of the performer, the people who have this, I love always the term discretionary power, yeah. They discriminate with their discretionary power and they get away with it.
Yeah, exactly. And it is, I mean, you know, that you cannot get anybody talking about it, a situation that is so disgusting. I mean, fortunately, the Taylor Report discusses it and a few other media take it up. But, you know, and this is the case of Jerome Bichirimpaka is absolutely disgusting. It concerns it. With the Minister of Public Security, he's the man who's blocking it. The Minister of Public Security. Security. He is there in Toronto, Mendocino, I think his name is, Marco Mendocino. He is the man who right now, the file, Jerome Bichirimpaka's file is in his office. Mm-hmm. And, you know, he could settle the problem tomorrow. But the man has been in prison for 22 or 23 years, or in prison or in house arrest now. And he never did anything wrong. And he was acquitted. I mean, it's just, it's imagine the cases here. When that comes, people, it's a scandal when it comes out that somebody been wrongly accused, has spent time in prison, he gets, or she gets indemnities for that. It becomes a big, big legal issue. But here, no, you know, yes. In this case,
We're speaking to Robin Philpott, whose articles on these cases is published by Canadian Dimension. And really, people have to read these articles. Robin, it occurs to me that part of what's going on here, this difficulty with Niger, the difficulty mm-hmm. that seems to be emerging, certainly with Mali, part of this is that these are former colonies who at the time this tribunal was established were being leaned on heavily by the New World Order, which in that day, that 1994 was still very much a Bush-Clinton wonder period where America was going to sort everybody out. Yeah. But that the winds have been blowing a little differently now in Africa. And it could be that the people running the penal colonies don't want to play ball anymore.
Right. Yeah, no. Well, yes.
They would probably agree, like, if the tribunal would say, okay, we're sorry, we imposed this situation on you, we will now take them to The Hague, that yeah. would be the solution, because they'd say, yes, you created the damn problem, you treated these Africans like dirt, we took yeah. them in, but now you don't solve the problem, and we can't solve that for you. So you're the UN, do it yourself. Take them to The Hague.
Right, right. That is the solution. That is the solution. And you cannot get, these countries have their own concerns, their own preoccupations. We also know that hanging in the wings is the Rwandan Patriotic Front and Paul Kagame. And he wants to bring them back to Rwanda and put them in double jeopardy, put them in prison, have new trials, and, you know, for these same people. Whereas the international body acquitted them or gave them sentences, and they served those sentences. Now, and I think that these same countries we're talking about, the US, the UK, Canada, Belgium, France, they would rather just send them back to Rwanda, because they're saying officially Rwanda's a democratic country. They just ignore, refuse to listen to all the reports of murders in the country, murders outside, executions outside the country, disappearances, intervention, or invasion of neighboring countries. They just turn a blind eye to it all. And and then they say,
this is even after the Hollywood gentleman, Russo Sabagino, quite celebrated by the world, given a medal by Bush, President Bush, and now sits in a prison in Rwanda. And the Americans, who said he was a hero, won't even help him out.
Won't lift a finger for him. He was kidnapped, by the way, as you remember.
Yes.
And sit over there. So they basically, international law means nothing to that government. And the nine people we're talking about, plus the five that are in Mali and others, they are totally right in not wanting to go near Rwanda.
Well, of course.
Knowing that history. And so people sometimes they say, well, why don't they go to Rwanda, those people? And they say no. They say no, and they are right.
Well, of course, and by the way, you mentioned, that, of course, that they would be in a type of double jeopardy, but actually I noticed that the Rwandans have already framed the question, and they raised it. They talked about this matter of the eight individuals in Niger, and they because the tribunal said, well, if we would never send them. We've already said that they cannot be tried again for these. However, Rwanda is rather cute. They say, no, we want to try them for new crimes. They're going to allege that they were somehow or another, as they did with Russo Sabagina. There's somehow a link, and they will have brand new charges. And then, so where would the tribunal's argument be then? Where they are clearly legitimate refugees.
Right. Yeah, exactly. No, they are. They are. There's one aspect as well, is that, sending people, like these people all have families, children, grandchildren in some cases, in the countries where they could go and join with them, and they've earned it. They have the right to live with their families, live the rest of their life. Sending people from Arusha to Niger is like sending somebody from Toronto to Quito in Ecuador, or sending, like sending them.
Yes.
Just like, but everybody has this vision that Africa, well, they're all the same. It's really disgusting.
It's the old ocean notion. It's one place. One African is like another.
Yeah.
And it is racial and colonial thought. I just want to mention something I remember clearly, and is part of the record. The first president of the tribunal and the head of the court was Judge Kama, and Kama was asked why they weren't being tried at The Hague, and his answer was, the trial is in Africa for cultural and social reasons. That sounded so nice. It was so like, well, it's social. But actually what he meant is the colonial concept of Africa being separate, less, and they are to be given inferior treatment. That was the exact word, social and cultural reasons. You say, could somebody translate? What do you mean? By the way, my first spontaneous reaction was, when I heard that, was I don't get this social. My client, the one I was working for, spoke about four languages, three of them European languages. He was far better educated than I was. He was already a highly successful business person who worked in Europe. He did his business in Europe. And so what, but for social cultural reasons, he has to be tried in Africa.
Just amazing. Louis Arbour, by the way, talked like that too. There were cases where they would kidnap people and arrest them. You know, like, remember it was in Kenya, and I don't remember the name of the person, but then she answered, well, we have to do things differently in Africa. You know, in other words, we don't follow the rules that we would in a Canadian court. I mean, she said this. It was,
yes. So she thought she was the Wild West or Wild Africa. Yes. Yeah, and by the way, I do remember one of the episodes was that they kidnapped. They took them out of Kenya. They arrested them in Nairobi.
Right.
And the Kenyan authorities were only there as observers. They were not. Did not participate. They didn't identify the individuals. And when they got to Arusha, they discovered they had actually arrested one person who was the wrong person.
Right.
And they spent about 10 days, maybe 2 weeks, in deep embarrassment in total silence, because they didn't know what to do with this individual. Yeah. And they had managed to get him across the border into Tanzania.
Right.
Because the Tanzanian authorities deferred to them.
Yeah.
Instead of checking them as they would an ordinary person crossing their border, let me see your papers, I want to know who you are, etc. Right. They were in the clutches of the UN, that would be our board's people.
Yeah.
And therefore, off they went.
And that was the incident where she said, we have to do things differently in Africa. In other words, she justified what she did there. Mm-hmm. And the man was held for all that time, and he was not the person. He wasn't the person who they were looking for. But she justified that, saying, well, sometimes we have to cut corners because we're in Africa. I mean, it's so profoundly prejudiced.
Yeah. You know? By the way, Kenya has a parliament. Kenya has a Supreme Court. Kenya has a judiciary. It has police. It is a sovereign state that functions, therefore. Yeah. But to say, no, I'm going to just dispense with them.
Yeah,
we could go back one more step. The President Moi was one of the leaders of Africa who didn't like this whole concept.
No.
And said he had to be concerned about Kenyan sovereignty. He was worried about international police people coming into his country and doing what they actually ended up doing, arresting the wrong person and exiting. That person was his responsibility in Kenya, and they arrested him and took him to another country.
Right. It's amazing. And so that's what you have now, these case of these nine people in Niger. And I want to really hit on that case. The eight people in Niger and one in Arusha. This is probably the result of 25 years of prejudice and colonial attitudes applied to a judicial system whose goal, as David Sheffer said, was to advance US and NATO interests. The tribunal, that was what it was doing. It was not justice. And these men and their families are the ones who are paying the price of that kind of prejudice, profound prejudice in what they call Western countries.
Yeah. By the way, I should tell our listeners, we're speaking to Robin Philpott, and his article is in Canadian Dimension. There is a Twitter account, Save Our Parents.
Right.
And I really would urge people to go to that as well, to keep daily track, because these are the children primarily created the site, so that they can try to rally people to win the freedom of their parents. This is one of those things, Robin, I'm sure you can affirm, which is obscure and outrageous, and really should Canadians who believe in human rights, who own all this, they should be knocking on the doors of powerful people saying, what are you doing?
Yeah, exactly. Jerome Bichirampaka, who's in Arusha, after my first article appeared, he wrote me a very nice note, and he said, and what struck in my mind, other than a few nice words, was very pleasant words, was people are not interested in African subjects, in African issues. The people sitting there, and this, you know, they realize that just to get people talking about a scandal, a flagrant injustice, is like, it's very, very difficult in Africa. But you could talk about it in some other places. And I think there's some of those are going to be your subject after yes. we've talked. But yes. they get all the news. But when Africans are when there's something that for which these our countries are responsible, zero, yeah. silence. You know.
Yeah, no, that is the most important point. I'm really glad you cite Jerome, who's an outstanding individual, represented yeah. his country at the United Nations, by the way.
Yeah.
Very eloquently, and took a lot of abuse for doing so. Let's hope we have some progress on this. I'm really glad those articles were published. I look forward to your writing on this more. And
We have to, you know, we have to. I sent the first article, a very Canadian article about Jerome and his family, who's here, to all the major media in Canada, you know, a lot of them, you know, and, you know, it was a very straightforward article. I wasn't claiming all kinds of things about the history of Rwanda. It was a down to earth human interest story. They didn't want to touch it. They didn't yes. want to touch it.
Yes. You know. Yeah. It's nobody as blind as the one who doesn't want to see.
Oh, exactly.
That's them. Robin Philpott, it's been great talking to you. And we will stay with this, and I hope people will go to that Twitter account, Save Our Parents. Thank you very much.
Thanks, Phil. Thanks for inviting me.
Okay. This is the Tater Report, and we'll be right back.